The United States has certain competitive advantages that I think China can't readily replicate. I believe on the flip side, China has certain competitive advantages that the United States cannot readily replicate. As China becomes more confident in its global role, I think that China also wants to do some recasting of the narrative that it played in World War II. I think that there's a real conviction in the United States, or at least in substantial parts of the U.S. foreign policy community, that China is intent on supplanting the United States. And I think that there's a comparably intense conviction in vast segments of the Chinese foreign policy community and also the Chinese public that the United States is determined at all costs to suppress not only its technological development, but also by extension, therefore, its economic development.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Ambo, and I'm joined on this episode by Ollie Wine. Longtime listeners of the podcast will recognize his name. He's a close watcher of China with deep expertise on the U.S.-China relationship, and he's been a guest before. As a senior research and advocacy advisor for U.S.-China relations at the International Crisis Group, he approaches the subject of this integral geopolitical relationship from both sides. What the United States seeks to achieve vis-a-vis China and how it views the strategic competition between the two is important. But so is Beijing's perspective, its objectives and interests, and how it conceptualizes its relationship with the United States. That's the subject of the discussion you're about to hear. Before we get to it, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Ollie Wine. Ollie, thank you so much for joining me once again on the MWI podcast.
Thank you for having me back. It's great to be back.
We've had you on a couple of times. I think each time we've had you on, you've had a different employer. You were at RAND, I believe, the first time. Last time you were at the Eurasia Group when we had you on to talk about your book on strategic competition. You are now at the International Crisis Group. Can you just very briefly kind of talk about, you know, what brought you there?
Sure. Well, first, it's great to be back, and I really appreciate your having me on your podcast. It's always wonderful to talk with you. So there were a number of motivations. I was having a wonderful time at Eurasia Group, had a terrific experience there. Someone who, you know, worked at the International Crisis Group, you know, reached out and said that, you know, Ollie, we're looking to, you know, the organization is looking to do more work on the U.S.-China relationship. And we, for a while now, have had folks who they do terrific analysis, who are based in Asia. But ICG made the decision, the leadership made the decision that it wanted somebody based in Washington to add with an explicit focus on advocating with folks on the Hill, with government officials. And again, per ICG's mandate, somebody based in D.C. to advocate for policies and promote policies, hopefully to reduce the risk of an armed confrontation between the United States and China. So because of that invitation, because of my respect for ICG, I had also never worked at a civil society organization before, mm-hmm. where advocacy is not an informal part of the job, but a formal part of the job. I also respect, you know, ICG because many of our, you know, many of my colleagues are, when they talk about various armed conflicts around the world, they very often are reporting from conflict zones. They're deeply immersed in the subjects of which they speak. And I guess the last reason why I was really excited to join, you know, ICG is that because ICG is a little bit newer to doing, you know, work explicitly on the U.S.-China relationship, there's a little bit more of an opportunity to, I guess, sort of stamp my kind of intellectual imprimatur and help ICG think about some of its foundational coordinates about the relationship. But deeply grateful to be at the organization, deeply respectful of the mandate that it fulfills every day, and looking forward to continuing to build up its body of work on what I think, although I'm a bit biased, but what I think objectively is the world's most consequential bilateral relationship.
I don't think that that's overstatement by any means. You're a senior research and advocacy advisor for U.S.-China relations. Obviously, a relationship has two parties. I mentioned to you, and I'll say this for the listeners' benefit, that I'll consider this episode a success if I've managed to sort of maybe help listeners break free of some of the impulses sometimes to look at it through a U.S. policy lens and maybe, you know, think about what this strategic rivalry, strategic competition, whether or not those are the right words to even use from Beijing's perspective, but what all that looks like from the perspective of Beijing, the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping. I guess to start, we just saw a pretty important military parade and, you know, some other events in China. I think the reason that it made the biggest news was because of who was there alongside Xi Jinping, Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. I think that that was pretty momentous. Can we just maybe to kick off, can you talk about, you know, I guess what were your initial impressions when it was announced that those leaders would be coming and joining Xi Jinping at the parade to mark this occasion?
I think a number of reactions. I think the first is that I think contrary to speculations in at least some speculations in the West, and I think in particular in the United States, sort of circa the Wolf Warrior Diplomacy era, and I think that when you and I last spoke, we reflected a lot on Wolf Warrior Diplomacy. There was a lot of speculation, and I think not without some measure of justification, that China was embarking on a course that would really torpedo its diplomatic efforts, its diplomatic outreach. And we saw that in 2020, in 2021, you know, China, I think quite actively and counterproductively, despite having, I think, a window of opportunity to make amends with many of its neighbors and to make further outreach with core U.S. allies and partners, we saw that it undermined quite steadily and rapidly its relationships with its neighbors in Asia. I think because of the way that it conducted itself, it prevented itself from signing this major investment agreement with the European Union. All the way of saying, by way of context, that a few years ago, I think that there was a speculation, especially in the United States, that China would really compound its diplomatic encirclement, really that it would compound itself diplomatic encirclement. So my initial reaction to the parade is the extent to which I think China has broken out of the diplomatic isolation that some observers had predicted it would succumb to as recently as a few years ago. And importantly, I mean, you mentioned, taking the leaders you mentioned Vladimir Putin, you mentioned, you know, Kim Jong-un. I don't subscribe to this notion of an axis of authoritarians. And I think that
why not?
I'm skeptical. So I'm skeptical because whenever you say axis of X, axis of evil, axis of authoritarians, axis of, you know, fill in the blank, you run the risk, an analytical risk, which also has policy ramifications, of imbuing a grouping of countries with undue strategic coherence. And if you look at, so take this notion of an axis of authoritarians, and we haven't mentioned Iran, but I'll include it for the purposes of our conversation. If you look at China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, I mean, these are four countries that have vastly different material capacities, vastly different strategic outlooks, vastly different strategies, foreign policy strategies. Now, I think it is fair to say that those four countries, they are bonded by and imbued with a shared animus, shared grievances, particularly against the United States, against the present configuration of the international system.
Sure.
And shared grievances are a powerful motor of strategic alignment, and I would be the last person to dismiss that proposition. Shared grievances, however, are a far cry from shared aspirations. So if you were to ask me, Ali, what do China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea collectively oppose, I could come up with, and I think we could both come up with a list of shared grievances pretty quickly. If you were to then say, what is it that those four countries have a shared vision of international order? I might say to you, well, those four countries seek a more multipolar order. But then I think you might rejoin properly, well, many of America's core allies and partners also want a more multipolar order.
Sure.
And so I would caution against ascribing, I think, unwarranted strategic coherence to those four countries, number one. Number two, you don't want to run the risk of providing, by virtue of external pressure, strategic lubrication that would facilitate that alignment that those four countries organically might not possess. So that's just a comment on this notion of sort of an axis of authoritarians. I think it's also very important to include India. I mean, India's presence, Modi's presence, is extraordinarily significant.
Yes.
Against the backdrop of this deterioration in the U.S.-India relationship. And I think it's difficult to overstate. I mean, some folks talk about the optics of the summit, and the optics were important. But not just the optics, also the real practical, the practical strategic import of what has taken place. I mean, keep in mind, when we look at the U.S.-India relationship, I think that the U.S.-India relationship over the course of the past quarter century, and I think especially over the course of the past decade, on a bipartisan basis, whether you look at the Obama administration, the first Trump administration, I think that there was an optimism in both Washington and Delhi that because of shared apprehensions over Beijing's conduct, those shared apprehensions would essentially increasingly and indefinitely imbue the relationship with momentum. That momentum is now very much in question, and therefore, by extension, the future of the Quad, I think, is in question. The future of the Indo-Pacific strategy that has really driven U.S.-China policy is also in question. And what we see now with India, with Modi's presence at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, is that it is not only that some of America's principal adversaries and competitors are increasingly acting in concert and consulting with one another. With India's presence, it's now one of America's most critical partners that is consulting with two of America's principal adversaries and competitors about how to de-risk more aggressively and intentionally from the United States, how to facilitate greater multipolarity. So I think that what we saw at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, you never want to say that geopolitical dynamics are irreversible. There is no such thing as sure. Irreversible momentum. But the direction of travel is significant. And I think that even if hypothetically, let's say that you and I record a podcast on Inauguration Day in 2029, even if the next commander in chief is sort of a kind of a traditional multilateralist, a traditional internationalist, I think that the next commander-in-chief would nonetheless find it very difficult to restore the U.S.-India relationship to sort of the status quo ante level of trust and momentum. And my sense, and then I'll stop my answer here, my sense now is that even if there is some repair work that can be done to the U.S.-India relationship, my sense now is that there's a recognition in both Washington and Delhi that the foundation on which their momentum had progressed in recent years was a tenuous one. And I think that I would expect India to pursue with much more vigor, much more alacrity, much more urgency, the so-called multi-alignment strategy that external affairs minister often describes. And that multi-alignment strategy will involve selective alignment with the United States, if and as circumstances warrant, but also, concerningly, from Washington's perspective, more conciliatory steps towards Beijing, and also, I think, a doubling down on the relationship with Moscow.
I think if you do look at the roster of attendees at the summit, it is quite fascinating. But if you think about, and this was the first one that India had attended, for instance,
right.
and I think we could probably record a separate podcast on the U.S.-India relationship and
sure.
U.S.-India-China triangulation. If we're focusing on China, and you know, not to make too much of it, but you know, realists will criticize me if I say the world can be split into good guys and bad guys, because that's just not the case. And yet, you know, I think objectively, you know, it wouldn't be unfair to label Russia as an aggressive, revanchist power, North Korea as an authoritarian family dictatorship. And you are, to some degree, judged by who your friends are. Do you think Beijing thinks in those terms at all? Do you think it cares? You know, do you think it knows, hey, we're kind of cozying up to the bad guys in a lot of these sort of, you know, global stories?
It's interesting. And I think that your question actually sort of takes me back to a footnote that I had wanted to add to the conversation about this notion of an axis of authoritarians. China really bristles at its inclusion in that category, because China, it likes to consider itself, and I think with some justification, it likes to consider itself as separate from those other three countries. And again, I say with some justification, because you know, China, unlike so if Russia, Iran, and North Korea, I'll come back to China in a minute, but Russia, Iran, and North Korea, I think that they each have recognized that the way that they can remind the rest of the world of their relevance is by fomenting disruption. I don't think that Russia Iran, North Korea, despite the grandiosity of their rhetoric about their place in the international system, I don't think that realistically they believe that they have the material wherewithal, the strategic vision to articulate an alternative conception of international order, let alone implement it in a way that a critical mass of humanity would find attractive. And therefore, they remind the rest of the world of their relevance by fomenting chaos. China, on the other hand, likes to see itself, and again, with justification, some justification, given the size of its economy, given the pace and the scale of its military modernization, given its centrality within a number of legacy international institutions, given its establishment of kind of a parallel architecture of initiatives and institutions, China sees itself as not a disruptor. China sees itself as a stabilizing force, a stabilizer in the international order. Now, we can dispute the extent to which that self-perception is legitimate, but China would present itself not as a disruptor, but as a stabilizer. And I think that unfortunately, again, from Washington's perspective, I do think that right now U.S. foreign policy is giving China an opportunity to legitimize that narrative. So China kind of separates itself from those other three countries. As to whether China cares, again, I don't think that China likes being lumped in with those three other countries. At the same time, my sense is that China feels that to some extent, the broad thrust of Western policy, and I think especially the broad thrust of U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis China, at this point is essentially baked in. There may be some disruptions in how a given commander-in-chief approaches China. There may be opportunities for tactical pauses and tactical resets. But I think 2018 is a really important inflection point in this regard when the first Trump administration announces that first tranche of tariffs and takes some of those preliminary actions against Huawei. Yeah. 2018 is a real inflection point when the leadership in China says, look, henceforth, we now have to conclude that the United States, regardless of who occupies the White House, is going to take concerted measures to stymie our technological development. And so I think that from China's perspective, just as one example, when Russia invaded Ukraine and when Western observers would say, China, don't you appreciate how much damage you're doing to your standing? And perhaps China underestimated how much reputational damage it ultimately would incur. But when Western interlocutors or commentators would say, China, don't you appreciate how much damage you're doing to your diplomatic standing by financing Russian aggression, by doubling down on your support for this alleged no limits partnership? I think that China's rejoinder, and I think it's a rejoinder that it increasingly subscribes to, is even if we, meaning China, even if we hypothetically were to do a 180 on our relationship with Russia. So even if we were to come out tomorrow morning and say we denounce Russian aggression against Ukraine and we are going to make common cause in the West in trying to stop further Russian aggression, I think the conclusion that China's leadership has reached is even that wholesale hypothetical recalibration would not change the fundamental thrust of Western and especially U.S. policy towards China. And so the conclusion is if even that wholesale recalibration wouldn't change U.S. policy towards China, why would we dispense with a useful partner if we're not going to accrue any strategic dividends as a result? And so I suspect that China is likely going to double down on its relationship with Russia, which it views as a useful partner, albeit sort of a ham-fisted partner, but a useful partner in terms of provisioning vital commodities. And I would say that China has perhaps a kind of a three-layer diplomatic strategy for trying to offset external Western pressure. So the first part is doubling down on relations with U.S. adversaries, so Russia, Iran, North Korea. Level two is strengthening relationships with so-called middle powers or swing states or pivot states, whatever your preferred nomenclature. But these are countries, the Indonesias, the Turkeys, the South Africas of the world, that are looking to play the United States and China off of one another and believe that they can successfully play Washington and Beijing off of one another. And the third part of China's diplomatic counteroffensive, and I would argue, I think the linchpin of its diplomatic counteroffensive is strengthening its comprehensive footprint across vast swaths of the developing world, which have very dark memories of the first Cold War. They have no desire to be entrapped in a second one. So I think that China is pursuing that three-part diplomatic strategy to push back against external pressure.
Do you think, and this is at risk of going off into a tangent, the point that you made about China saying, even if we had taken a different tack with or we turned our back on Russia as this, you know, partner of the moment, ally of the moment, you know, it wouldn't fundamentally change U.S. or Western policy vis-a-vis China. Do you think there was an opportunity in February of 2022 for the White House to get on the phone and offer anything that could have swayed China toward sort of joining this worldwide coalition of, you know, of Ukrainian supporters, or at least to stand on the sidelines?
Yeah, it's, well, so here's my sense is, and again, I think that a lot of, I think a lot of the details of what all China has provisioned to Russia, I suspect that at least in the, in terms of what sort of is publicly available knowledge, I think that there's a lot that we, there's a lot that I think is classified, sensitive, private that we don't know.
Sure.
My sense, and again, I want to underscore that word sense because, again, I'm not privy to what all China has actually provisioned. My sense is that China initially was a little bit more on the sidelines than it is now. I think that it was initially a little bit more, I think it was initially concerned about the reputational damage that it might incur by really doubling down on supporting Russia. My sense, though, is that as time has passed, I think the Chinese support for Russian aggression, albeit you know indirect, I think has increased. And I think that there was a very, I'm forgetting where this conversation took place. I believe it was in a conversation between Wang Yi, who is China's top diplomat. And I believe it was his European Union counterpart. I could be wrong, but there was a conversation that took place between Wang Yi and one of his European counterparts in which he kind of let slip in a revealing way, saying that China can't afford for Russia to lose. I thought that was a very telling admission on his part. China is not aloof to or insouciant to the risk of doubling down on its support for Russian aggression. But again, you make trade-offs. And so I think that from China's perspective, China, I think, is concerned that if Russia were to lose, would, you know, what would the potential emboldening effects be in the West? What might the West do in terms of supporting Taiwan? What more might it do to support Taiwan? What more might it do to support arrangements such as AUKUS? What more might it do to strengthen various forms of security and technological cooperation between the United States and U.S. allies and partners in Asia, including Japan, South Korea, Australia, and so forth? And so I think that China is concerned that if Russia loses, however you define losing, but if Russia were to lose against Ukraine, Taiwan might feel more emboldened, and the United States and the collective West might feel that look, we expended a lot of diplomatic heft, we expended a lot of financial or provided a lot of financial support, and we ultimately prevailed. And so, if we were ultimately able to prevail over Russian aggression against Ukraine, you know, we now have sort of proof of concept that if China were to sort of go for the jugular against Taiwan, or if China were to go for the jugular against the Philippines, you know, our prevailing against Russia, fighting back against its aggression in Ukraine, gives us confidence. We have a proof of concept. We have confidence now that we can repel potential Chinese aggression. And so I think that China was concerned about the precedent that a Russian loss would set. My sense now is that China feels like it's kind of in a more comfortable place diplomatically than it was, you know, maybe 6 months ago, 9 months ago, 12 months ago, because on the one hand, the front line between Russia and Ukraine doesn't really appear to be moving. Russia-Ukraine has settled into a, comfortable is the wrong word, it's a very bloody but somewhat stable kind of war of attrition. And I think that Russia feels that it has time on its side. China, therefore, feels that it has time on its side. And on the flip side, as this ghastly, grisly war of attrition is playing out between Russia and Ukraine without any evident end in sight, I think that China discerns sort of new diplomatic opportunities to make inroads with longstanding U.S. allies and partners. And I think, again, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit was a very clear demonstration, because China is not only thinking about how to strengthen relations with, you know, the Russias of the world, you know, the North Koreas of the world, it also now is thinking about how it can consolidate this incipient rapprochement between Beijing and Delhi. So I think that if you are, and many of the countries that remain very critical of how China is conducting itself vis-a-vis Russia, they now are at least as apprehensive about some of the foreign policy signals coming out of Washington. And so, you know, one of the quips that you often hear is that many U.S. allies and partners, they're concurrently looking to de-risk from China and from the United States.
Well, I want to shift gears a little bit to narrative, although I think the military parade offers still sort of a useful jumping off point for that, because, you know, when I was watching footage of the parade, I was particularly interested in the new equipment and weapon systems that were being put on display. And then I saw you tweet something that was effectively about, look, this parade is Xi telling a story. And, you know, we all do this, right? When we talk about the US-led liberal order, we're telling a story about the world. You had mentioned in there that with this parade, Xi was aiming to weave together narratives about the country's past, its present, and its future. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Sure. And I appreciate your flagging that tweet. And I should also say, I should also flag just actually before I dive into answering, I think that the Chicago Council and the Carter Center, they just put out a really fascinating, I think really compelling survey. It just came out, so today is September 4th, it came out September 3rd. But looking at, there's a lot of speculation about how China's leadership thinks about China's role in the world. This survey effort by the Chicago Council and the Carter Center was an attempt to survey how just members of the mainland Chinese public think about China's role in the world. And my big takeaway, and I'll circle back to sort of these three narratives that you mentioned. My big takeaway from their survey is it's not only that China's leadership isn't convinced that China's aggregate power is at risk of plateauing anytime soon. There's very little, if any, evidence that the Chinese public subscribes to those kinds of judgments either. And so I think that the Chinese leadership and the Chinese public, without being sanguine about the multiplicity of challenges that China faces at home and abroad, I think that there's a broadly shared conviction that China is hardy, it's resilient, it's becoming more independent, and that it's comprehensively going to go stronger. So circling back to the narratives, and you're right, every country tries to tell stories for domestic consumption, for international consumption. So three narratives. First, a narrative about the past. As China becomes more confident in its global role, I think that China also wants to do some recasting of the narrative that it played in World War II. And I think that China has long felt that China played a critical role in ending World War II with its defeat of Japan, but a role that is perhaps underappreciated in contemporary histories of World War II. And
they're not necessarily wrong to feel that way.
I mean, there are a number of actors that played important roles in ending World War II. So I think that, and the reason that I think that China feels that it's important to sort of shore up and gain traction for this narrative about its role in World War II is that we often hear again in the West, and particularly in the United States, that, you know, China is a disruptor. It's a disruptor, it's a revisionist. It is trying to undermine, you know, the present international system. And so I think the one objective that the President Xi and his top advisors might have in trying to gain traction for this narrative is to say, hey, you know, this order that you allege in the West that we're disrupting would not have come into being were it not for an active Chinese role. So there's the narrative about sort of highlighting what China believes is the underappreciated role that it played in ending World War II. Then bringing us to the present, I think China wants to demonstrate that in the past, we played an important role in ending World War II and ushering in this post-war order, and that at present, especially given some of the convulsions in the West and especially in the United States, that China is trying to portray itself as a stabilizing force in international order. So China is trying to say that while some other countries might be retreating from free trade agreements, we are signing more free trade agreements. While certain other countries are maybe retrenching from international institutions and from multilateralism writ large, China is doubling down on international institutions and multilateralism. And so I think that China's narrative about its present is we are an integral pillar of the international order, and we are trying to stabilize an order that is under duress from within and from without, but we are a key player in stabilizing that system. And then the third and arguably most consequential narrative, albeit by definition a speculative one, is a narrative about its future. And the narrative is that China is becoming hardier in the face of external pressure. It is becoming more self-reliant in terms of achieving greater technological self-reliance. It is becoming hardier in terms of modernizing its military. It's becoming hardier in terms of deepening its centrality within a range of global supply chains. And so the narrative is that as time passes, despite all of the hardships we face at home, despite an increasingly contested external outlook, that China is going to become more resilient to external pressure, more capable of standing on its own, and more capable of resuming a more central role in international affairs. And I would just end by saying that I think that from China's perspective, I think that recent months have given Beijing grounds for not unalloyed confidence, but cautious grounds for cautious confidence. I mean, you'll remember that if we had been recording this podcast, say, in early April or in late March, I think that there was a sense that because of China's structural headwinds, a slowing rate of economic growth, demographic decline that's becoming more pronounced, inflationary contagion, or excuse me, deflationary contagion in the real estate sector, et cetera, that China was in a structurally vulnerable place. And there was a concern, I think, among China's leadership that, you know, if and then we've ultimately when the United States imposed very high tariffs and then ratcheted them up, I think that there was perhaps an undue sense of hubris in the United States that China would sort of quickly wave the white flag and say, look, you know, we already are so economically stressed at home, we can't deal with this, sort of this added burden of ever ratcheted up tariffs. Not only did China not end up waving the white flag, but China, in the course of thinking about how to respond to U.S. economic pressure, discovered that it has some very potent sources of leverage of its own. And I think chief among them, rare earths production and processing. And given China's extant dominance when it comes to rare earth production and processing, there is a lot of discussion about diversifying away from Chinese rare earths. There's a lot of activity about how you know, how governments and how companies can partner to diversify away. But just, we have to introduce some temporal realism into this conversation. In terms of meaningfully diversifying away from China's rare earths, that undertaking, I think, is a generations-long undertaking, which means that for the indefinite, I would say for the indefinite future, China, you know, whether it comes to bilateral negotiations with the United States or whether it comes to negotiations with other major powers in the international system, if and when those actors pressure China to make various concessions, whether in the economic domain, the security domain, the technological domain, I think that China indefinitely will be able to dangle as a kind of a sort of a negotiating sort of Damocles, the curtailment of rare earth exports in a way that will be very difficult for its interlocutors to respond to effectively.
You know, when we talk about, you know, what does China want? We can talk about, you know, concrete objectives like reunification with Taiwan. We can talk about regional hegemony, perhaps, you know, global hegemony, although I'm not sure that there's a lot of evidence that China seeks, you know, unipolarity in that sense. We talk about, you know, kind of a shift from, you know, the past three decades of a unipolar US-led world to one of multipolarity. But we use this lexicon, right? A certain vocabulary to try to talk about what China wants. Does that lexicon translate? Can it be transported and applied to Beijing's thinking? When Beijing looks at the world and it thinks about its both what we would call strategic competition or strategic rivalry between the United States and China, and its overall objectives, you know, do we have to maybe expand that lexicon, that vocabulary, in order to account for the nuances of I guess, you know, Chinese strategic thinking?
Absolutely. I think that nuance is always good. more nuance is always better. And I do think that some of the discourse around China's strategic objectives, some of the discourse about, you know, sort of Sino-centric, you know, futures, I do think that it's sometimes is wanting, you know, for nuance. I would offer a few thoughts. First, I think that China's strategic objectives, I think that we have to account for a certain malleability in those objectives. And malleability, one, because China has had different leaders, you know, since the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. Some leaders are more passive, some are more ambitious. So one, leaders have, you know, leadership matters. It sounds like a kind of an underwhelming kind of sort of self-evident statement, but I think that we run the risk when we talk, even the question, what does China want? You know, China is, you know, it is a country of 1.4 billion people. There are, you know, different strands of thinking within China's leadership. So China has had different leaders, again, and leaders exhibiting different temperaments. And so that's one source of malleability, potential malleability. And also, China's international environment, China's domestic politics have undergone many oscillations in the decades since the founding of the PRC. China's international environment has undergone, of course, profound upheavals during that same time. And so recognizing, of course, that it's not as though China's strategic objectives can be fully knowable. But I think that basic intuition suggests that, you know, Chinese leaders adapt depending on the combination of evolving domestic politics and evolving the evolving character of the international system. So I would make that point, and we should allow for the possibility, and I would argue the likelihood, that as China has different leaders, as China's internal and external politics, you know, shift, that there might be some flexibility in China's strategic objectives. And then there's a conversation, and I feel that too often we don't do enough to distinguish between, or at least discuss separately, intentions and capabilities. Let's stipulate for argument's sake, the maximalist conception of China's strategic objectives. So let's stipulate, again, for argument's sake, and I say for argument's sake because there is indeed a very vigorous debate over what it is ultimately that China wants. I would point actually to an op-ed from, I think it was published in late 2023 by Jessica Chen Weiss, a friend and a mentor. And I think both as a scholar, as a practitioner, I think one of the most indispensable voices in recent years who has expanded this Overton window for thinking about what it is that China wants. And so she wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. I believe it was published in, I think it was December of 2023, but I'll have to check the date to make sure it's right. She makes the point, and I think quite convincingly, that even China's leaders are not necessarily convinced that China can replace the United States for global preeminence. And this point is very important. And as we were actually just about to hop on the call, I was reading another op-ed, just came out actually either today or yesterday, by Sam Raghavan at the Lowy Institute. And he says that whatever one might think about China's strategic objectives, he makes the point, and again, I am very sympathetic to it, even if one were to believe that China wanted to overtake the United States for global preeminence, dissolve the current order, put in its place a Sino-centric order, there are real questions about whether China could achieve regional dominance, let alone global dominance. So I think that it's very important that on the intention side, that we not say that the debate has been settled. I think that there is still a very vigorous debate within China, outside of China, over what China wants. And so we shouldn't artificially suggest that debate is over. And then on the capability side, even if we stipulate that China has grandiose ambitions in its region and beyond, do we think that China could actually fulfill those objectives? And I think if you look at, again, China's internal situation and its external landscape. Internally, I enumerated some of China's internal difficulties, but it's worth reiterating them. China's baseline rate of growth is slowing down. Demographic decline is really beginning to pinch. The difficulties in the real estate sector are not going away. And I think fundamentally, China is finding it very difficult to transition away from its erstwhile economic model to a newer economic model that relies more on consumption, that relies more on innovation. And Professor Yuan Yuan Ang, who used to be at the University of Michigan, she's a brilliant political economist, now is at Zeiss, along with Professor Weiss. And she makes a great point, and one that I hadn't even occurred to me until I read some of her analysis. She said, the old Chinese economy and the new Chinese economy that China is hoping to achieve, they're intimately and perhaps irreducibly intertwined.
Yeah.
And China's ability to get to a new economic model is predicated on the success of the old economic model. And so getting to a new economic model will be challenging. And if you turn to then China's periphery, my gosh, look at China's geography. Who are your neighbors? China has 14 neighbors. Among them are very volatile states, such as North Korea, and also very successful, proud, confident democracies, Australia, Japan, South Korea, that are not going to just readily acquiesce to Chinese hegemony. And so all a way of saying that, one, let's not artificially settle this debate over China's strategic objectives. And two, even if for argument's sake we assume the maximalist case, let's not discount the range and severity of vulnerabilities that China faces at home and abroad that would constrain it from implementing even a very grandiose vision for its place in the world.
I asked you earlier if there was perhaps an opportunity in February 2022 to offer China something to sort of, you know, recalibrate its approach or to get it, you know, ideally in an extreme case on side with, you know, condemning Russian aggression against Ukraine. You know, it's one of the things that I've noticed about public discussions about U.S. policy toward China recently is that it's often about deterring, about constraining. You know, we talk a lot about essentially trying to stop China from achieving whatever it wants to achieve. There was a time where we did talk about that, but we also talked about shared interests, shared objectives. Yeah. Does Beijing think much in terms of shared interests and objectives, opportunities for collaboration, or, you know, has the relationship, you know, evolved to a point where also in China, their public discussion is perhaps overwhelmingly oriented on this sort of competition element of the relationship?
I am very worried about that. And I think your question, you know, kind of contains part of the answer, which is that there is a rapidly escalating cycle of distrust, not only between the leaderships in both countries, but I think also between the publics. And we see an atrophy of all kinds of people-to-people exchanges. So just one data point. There were roughly 11,000 American students who were studying in China in 2019. That number, as of last year, had fallen to about 800. I think that there are fewer Americans who are studying in China. There still are a large number of Chinese, you know, students who are studying in the United States, but that number is declining, and I suspect that number is at risk of further declining, just given the overall atmosphere of geopolitical distrust. So there's an atrophy of high-level diplomacy. There's an atrophy of people-to-people exchanges, and that atrophy creates an ideational vacuum in which distrust percolates and intensifies. So I am very concerned about that cycle, which is only intensifying. And there's a real conviction. I think that there's a real conviction in the United States, or at least in substantial parts of the U.S. foreign policy community, that China is intent on supplanting the United States. And I think that there's a comparably intense conviction in vast segments of the Chinese foreign policy community and also the Chinese public that the United States is determined at all costs to suppress not only its technological development, but also by extension, therefore, its economic development.
Sure.
So my starting point, so where do those admittedly sobering kind of pessimistic judgments leave us? John, my midway point and my ending point for thinking about the U.S.-China relationship, it's a seemingly underwhelming point, but I think it's an important one, which is the United States has certain competitive advantages that I think China can't readily replicate. I believe on the flip side, China has certain competitive advantages that the United States cannot readily replicate. Each country has a track record of defying declinist prognostications. Each country has a very impressive record of resilience. And so my starting midway point and ending point for thinking about the relationship is both countries need to disabuse themselves of speculations that the other in due course will collapse or will crumble. And both countries, even if they hold their nose and even if they do so begrudgingly, they need to accommodate themselves to the likelihood that the other will endure. And so the operative question for both countries is not how to achieve a decisive victory. It is instead how to articulate, how to operationalize, and how to sustain a frail, tense, and ultimately durable cohabitation. And neither country has much experience in grappling with that kind of question because both countries believe themselves to be exceptional in the annals of human history. And their articulations of exceptionalism in many regards are antithetical to one another. So the obvious question for both countries is, when you both believe yourselves to be exceptional in the annals of human history, when your respective articulations of exceptionalism are antithetical in foundational ways, when you don't have much practice in coexisting alongside a near peer or maybe in certain dimensions of power a peer, how do you get on? That question is very uncomfortable. It's interesting, and there's another essay that I'll point out in this regard. Rana Mitter is one of my favorite in this regard. He's one of my go-to sources of of analysis for thinking about not only China's place in the world, but for thinking about how we connect China's conception of its history with its conception of its present and its ideas about where it wants to go. And he made an essay that he wrote, I believe in 2021, it was a 2021 issue of Foreign Affairs, he made a very interesting observation. He said that in the West, we often enumerate what we believe China should not be allowed to do. We often enumerate what we believe to be illegitimate exercises of power on China's part. But he says, surely it's not reasonable to ask a country that possesses the second largest economy, the second largest defense budget, now the greatest number of diplomatic outposts of any country in the world. Surely a country can't construct its role in the world solely on the basis of what it is proscribed from doing. Surely there has to be some discussion of what China is allowed to do. And I would say that similarly, lest I be seen as only making certain exhortations or pleas to my friends in the United States. I say to friends in China as well that too often in China says the United States should not do X in our region. It is not allowed to do Y in our region. It should not contemplate Z in the international system. But again, the United States remains the world's preeminent power. So surely it's unreasonable for China to say only what it believes the United States is not allowed to do. So I think that both countries, they need to accept that indefinite cohabitation is a likelier outcome than a power transition between the two, even if they hold their nose. And they need to have a more serious conversation about what coexistence looks like. And that means an uncomfortable conversation, therefore, about what exercises of power the two countries would respectively consider legitimate. I think that until and unless they have those conversations, I don't see any way that we break out of this cycle of distrust. And until and unless the two countries make a more concerted effort to get back to the tradition of strategic empathy that once, I think, did play some role in structuring the bilateral relationship, I think it'll be very difficult for us to get out of this cycle of distrust.
You mentioned, while you were speaking just now, you mentioned that both China and the U.S. have sort of advantages that they can play, which sort of leads me to what I think will probably be my last question. You have a forthcoming paper that will be published in the next handful of days or so by the Stimson Center. And you argue in it, you gave me a bit of a sneak peek, you argue in it that China's principal competitive advantages vis-a-vis the United States are not diplomatic, not military, not economic, but psychological. So two questions. Number one, what do you mean by that? And number two, when I saw diplomatic, military, and economic, that almost looks like, that's three of the four instruments of national power, according to the DIME framework, right? The fourth being informational, but, which is almost like psychological, but you deliberately, I presume, chose the word psychological rather than using informational and fully structuring this argument along the DIME framework. Can you explain, what do you mean by that psychological advantage and how does that differ from, say, an informational advantage?
Well, sure. And I appreciate your flagging the paper, which, as you said, will hopefully be out in shortly, I think in a few days. I think maybe here just to, I'll answer by perhaps drawing on a little bit of just my own personal story. I mean, I came of age when the notion of the end of history wasn't a mere geopolitical construct. It really was an animating part of the national psyche. So when I was growing up and, coming of age in the early 90s, I really had internalized the notion of the end of history. And I say so because I've had to update over the course, not of years, over the course of decades, I've had to update my foundational assumptions about China. So when I was growing up, I did believe, because I had internalized this notion of the end of history, I did believe that China would forever be poor, forever be isolated, forever incapable of innovating. And I said, China's on the wrong side of history. It has a sense of itself that is antithetical to our own. So the reason that I use the word psychological is that when the country that is now your principal strategic competitor, arguably the most formidable strategic competitor that you have faced in your history, is a country that only 35 years ago is a country that you believed was on the wrong side of history. You believed articulated a conception of modernity that had been relegated to the ash bin of history. A country that at the time objectively was very poor, very isolated, very incapable of the kind of innovation that we see now. It's very difficult again, psychologically, to reconcile your hopes and or assumptions about where China would be in the international system and where it objectively is. And just to give you a sense of how difficult that kind of reconciliation is, I would point you to an essay that Gerald Siegel wrote in Foreign Affairs in, near the end of 1999. At the time, he was the director of studies at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and he wrote a famous essay entitled, Does China Matter? Now, sitting here a quarter century later, if I were to walk down Massachusetts Avenue and say, holding up a sign saying, does China matter? I think the passersby would ask if I, you know, they would do a welfare check. And they would say, well, of course China matters. But at the time, you know, Gerald Siegel, he was a very thoughtful observer. He wrote a controversial intervention, but he adduced a lot of compelling evidence to suggest that in 1999 that China was kind of a bit player in the international system. That bit player in the international system in the intervening quarter century has transformed into the second most powerful country in the international order. It is a country that, despite some erstwhile speculation that its power might peak, its comprehensive national power exhibits no signs of plateauing, and in fact, it continues to grow apace. And so psychological, because what China is demonstrating is that our conceptions about what it means to be exceptional, our meaning in the United States, our conception of what it means to be exceptional, our sense of where the world was going, our sense of our place within that evolving world, those senses are all now concurrently coming under strenuous daily assault by a country that proclaims an antithetical in many ways conception of exceptionalism. So I'll just conclude by saying, because I know we're sort of coming to time, to me, at the risk of sounding overly sort of binary or overly reductionist, it seems to me that America's greatest If America's greatest foreign policy challenge is psychological, it follows then that America's greatest foreign policy question is a psychological one. And namely, in dealing with a resurgent China, and I deliberately say resurgent rather than rising, because China says we are returning to
right.
a place of centrality that we once enjoyed. So I think that vocabulary matters. So China thinks of itself as a returning or resurgent power. So the United States has to ask itself that in dealing not only with a resurgent China, but also more broadly with an international order that is far more contested, far more congested, far more complex, will it proceed with equanimity or will it proceed with consternation? That is to say, will the United States accept in its bones that it operates in an international system very different from the one that prevailed 35 years ago, an international system wherein the United States will probably no longer be able to re-achieve the margin of preeminence that it once enjoyed? Will it accept that reality with composure and proceed with creativity, with nuance, with thoughtfulness? Or will it proceed with defensiveness, with alarmism, with hyperventilation, and attempt in very counterproductive ways to try to wrest back the 1990s, and in doing so, actually only hasten or accelerate its relative decline in the international system? So its principal foreign policy challenge is psychological. Its principal foreign policy imperative is psychological. And so the real choice at hand is, I think, for the United States, whether we proceed with composure or whether we proceed with consternation. I hope and believe that we can choose the former, but we can't diminish the risk that it ends up choosing the latter.
Well, I think that's an exceptional point to end on, some food for thought for listeners. I wanted to thank you again for joining me. It's always a fascinating conversation with you, and this one was no different. So thank you.
No, John, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to speak with you, and I always enjoy talking with you. And I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to be somewhat somewhat expansive and sometimes even loquacious in my answers. So thank you as always for the wonderful conversation and the invitation to come on.
Thanks, Ali. Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.